From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, there is a controversial ballot measure in Chicago, which voters will decide. It could raise taxes on some wealthier property sales in an effort to combat homelessness. Also, the city of Chicago trying to handle the influx of migrants who have been sent to the city from the southern border. There has been an apparent measles outbreak at the city's largest shelter. We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And with us back again, we have Heather Sharone with Chicago Tonight. Heather, it's always good to have you on the show with us.
I'm glad to be here, Sean.
So as we sit down to record this show, we want to mention it is Friday morning that we're recording. And the mayor of Chicago, Brandon Johnson, is expected to host a news conference just a little bit later on. So by the time people hear this show, they're going to already know what he said. But he is going to likely address an eviction policy at the city shelters. This was put in place, I guess it was late last year, and it's been delayed and delayed and delayed. So, Heather, what is going on with this? What does the mayor's policy do, and what would it mean to some of these migrants?
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty leading up to Saturday's deadline about who could sort of finally reach the 60-day limit imposed, as you said, by the mayor all the way back in November. Now, the first deadline hit just as Chicago was in the grips of bitterly cold temperatures, which prompted the mayor to suspend the deadline. He suspended it again about 2 weeks later, again saying that the weather was just, it wasn't possible to sort of turn essentially thousands of people out of city shelters without having anywhere for them to go. But he said that the deadline, he extended it until March 16th, which of course is Saturday. And despite my repeated requests for comment, and I'm sure that my colleagues at other news organizations have been doing the same, it's not clear whether the mayor will enforce the policy, and if he does, how many people it would affect. And this is, of course, all complicated by the apparent outbreak of measles at a shelter for migrants in Pilsen. It's the city's largest shelter, and it has been the subject of repeated complaints about cleanliness, sanitation, and it really has a lack of isolation rooms. So when illness has sort of, you know, popped up there, it has been very significant. And of course, this is the shelter where the five-year-old boy who died in December was living before he contracted sepsis and COVID-19, along with other illnesses. So there are a lot of questions. We're hoping to get some answers either from the mayor or his top advisors in just a little bit. But I think that it's just got to be incredibly hard for the thousands of people in the shelters, sort of living in somewhat dire circumstances to begin with, to try to figure out if they're going to have somewhere to sleep in the next 48 to 72 hours. Now, we asked the mayor about this on Wednesday, and he defended the policy, saying, look, it's not his fault that the city is struggling to care for the migrants. It's really the federal government's responsibility to figure out a solution to all of this. And that, of course, has been the state of affairs since the first migrants started arriving all the way back in August 2022. And it's really sort of once again coming to a head, even as the number of migrants in city shelters has dropped pretty significantly in the past month and a half by nearly a quarter.
Yeah, and I hate to beat the drum again, Charlie. We've talked about this before. We're expecting, though, that we could see the number of people who are being sent, especially on buses to Chicago, to likely go up as we get closer to the Democratic National Convention this year. But are you surprised, Charlie, that the federal government has not stepped in more at this point? I know there have been some policy changes, but maybe not anything as dramatic as what some of the local officials, not just in Chicago, but other cities have asked for.
Yeah, and I'm not sure, in my own mind, I'm not sure exactly how much authority the president has to act unilaterally. And if it requires getting anything done involving Congress, that's next to impossible, because I think it's pretty clear that the Republican majority in the U.S. House is very determined not to do anything that might look good for Biden, because they're in thrall to Donald Trump, who doesn't want anything that might look good for Biden as he tries to return to the presidency. So, yeah, the mayor's point is right. This is the federal government's problem. But on the other hand, Mayor, here you are today. This is a real situation in Chicago. We have these men, women, and children, a lot of children, and what are you going to do with them? You can't say, well, it's the federal government's problem, and just wash your hands of it. You have to be very proactive, and I'm anxious to see what next steps the mayor will take. The notion of saying, well, you've been in the shelter, but we're going to kick you out now, and you can go back to the drop-off zone and wait in line to see if you can get in the shelter again, that strikes me as being not very logical and pretty heartless, to be honest.
Yeah, Heather, I also wonder with Mayor Johnson, it seems as though, and you know him better than I do, I'm only reading some things and watching the reports from up there, but he doesn't seem as though he's somebody who likes to admit mistakes. A lot of politicians are like that. So you don't expect that this eviction policy would go away. It might be delayed, but you wouldn't expect that he's going to somehow reverse course on this?
Oh, absolutely not. He was very clear that he supported the policy. He said that it was an important tool for city officials to help migrants figure out what their next steps would be. Under former Mayor Lori Lightfoot, there were migrants who had lived in city shelters for more than a year, and many, many who were in for 6-7 months at a time. And that, the mayor says, isn't really helpful for them, nor is it something that the city can afford. So he sees this policy not so much as sort of a club or sort of punitive, but as an indication that it does no service to these migrants to allow them to sort of live in limbo without trying to help them get sort of their lives in Chicago and in America started. Now, that's complicated by the fact that a state program that offered at first 6 months and then 3 months of rental assistance is running out of money, and that migrants who entered city shelters after November are no longer eligible for that aid. That has all complicated things. And there, you know, it's one of those situations where if there was an easy answer or a clear answer, somebody already would have come up with it. But because this is such a difficult problem, and that there is just so many competing values, that it's almost impossible to figure out exactly what to do. But the mayor seems to think that, you know, that this sort of limits on shelter stays is the way to go. I think that it's the outbreak of the measles, as well as concerns about supercharging Chicago's homeless population, that is really making that effort difficult.
Well, let's move on then to another topic. And when it comes to finding suitable housing for people, not just the migrants, the city of Chicago voters will be deciding on Tuesday a referendum. It's been titled Bring Chicago Home. Just to let people know what this would do, it would raise the real estate transfer tax to 2%. That's about a tripling on properties over $1 million. It would raise it even higher for those properties over $1.5 million. So we're taxing these wealthier property sales, and Chicago's Mayor Brandon Johnson says that he supports this because he says the money then could go to providing more affordable housing. So, Heather, this has gone through a lot of court challenges, but it looks like voters will finally have their say on this.
That's right. The Supreme Court ruled just this week that the votes for and against this proposal will be counted. It comes after a Cook County judge invalidated the ballot measure and ordered the Chicago Board of Election Commissioners not to count the votes. That was overruled by a unanimous decision by a First District Appellate Court panel and then upheld by the Supreme Court, even though 3 of the 7 justices recused themselves from the decision without giving giving any reason, of course, in keeping with the rules governing the Supreme Court. This is going to be read, rightly or wrongly, as a big test of Mayor Johnson's political muscle. This has been a long-standing goal dating all the way back to 2015 of Chicago's progressive communities to create a dedicated source to help the unhoused in Chicago and to provide affordable housing. If it passes, it's not going to be sort of an immediate change. It then goes back to the Chicago City Council, which will have to vote on whether to sort of exercise this new power granted to them by voters if this passes. So we're going to see a number of big fights about this in the months to come. And I think that I will be looking very closely, of course, whether it passes or it fails, but I will also be looking at the margin of victory, because if it's a significant margin of victory, especially given all of the back and the forth with the court system, you're going to see progressive aldermen and Mayor Johnson claim a mandate to do this from voters. And that, I think, will shape the debate once it gets back to the city council in the coming months.
Charlie, we, and not just us, but others have criticized Mayor Johnson at times for not moving fast on certain things, or maybe not even offering up some of the ideas that other people say could help with certain problems in the city. But this, whether you approve of this or whether you're against this, at least there's something being done here.
Yeah, that's true. And I think the fact that the Supreme Court said that, yes, the thing stays on the ballot, the referendum question, and the votes will be counted, I don't think that that will be the end of the challenges to it. What the referendum would do would authorize the city council to pass an ordinance putting in place these new transfer taxes on real estate. But there is still, I suspect, going to be a challenge on down the road from the business owners and the other people who are opposed to it, arguing that the referendum itself was invalid because, and this is kind of getting in the weeds, it involved more than one subject in that it talked about increases, but it also talked about decreases, and the increases would require legislative action. The decreases could be done without legislative action. But the bottom line is, I don't think even if the referendum passes and the city council does in fact change the rates and put in this graduated structure, I don't think that's the end of its legal worries. I think we'll see, as I say, lawsuits filed by the people who opposed the referendum in the first place challenging the final results. Because one of the arguments that was made during the hearings at the lower court levels was that the challenge was not timely because this was part of a legislative agenda, and before the courts can step in, the legislative agenda has to be played out. And Heather, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but to me that suggested that there will be an opportunity for the opponents to challenge it further on down the line before the new rates actually go in place.
I think you're right, Charlie. There's no doubt that Chicago's real estate and business community sees this change the real estate transfer tax as an existential threat to their business, which of course has been reeling since the pandemic with the shift to remote work, and it has really changed sort of the fabric of office work, especially in the financial district in Chicago. The question to me is truly whether there's a relatively high standard for courts to interfere with the legislative branch of government. And I think that if, for example, you had a situation where this passes and then it is implemented by the city council and then it is tossed out by a court decision, I think that not only will you see that decision appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, which, as we know, is controlled by democratically aligned justices, I think that Chicago's progressive community would really use that as sort of a political rallying cry, and that this is really seen as sort of a way to sort of shift Chicago's governance as being sort of focused on the wealthy and the well-connected to a greater emphasis on helping sort of working class Chicagoans and middle class Chicagoans, and of course low income Chicagoans, who have really sort of found themselves bearing the brunt of sort of first the Great Recession, then the economic collapse caused by the pandemic, and now sort of the somewhat strong but still halting recovery. So it's going to be, whatever happens, a political Donnybrook.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, along with Charlie Wheeler and Chicago Tonight's Heather Sharon. Well, let's leave Chicago behind for just a minute here. Charlie, I want to go to some new revenue numbers that came out for the state this week. This is from the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability. It's like you always say, this is the economic forecasting arm for the legislature. The legislature uses their estimates for revenue and kind of helping set a budget. Of course, the governor has his own budget office. It looks as though both sides, or both of these groups, were really pretty close on numbers, at least from what the COGFA numbers came out this week, what those showed.
Yeah, the COGFA came out. And I think we mentioned it last week when we were talking about the most recent monthly report, that COGFA was going to come out with its revenue estimate for the current fiscal year and its projection for FY25. And they did last week. And basically, they're pretty much in agreement of the way things are going to go forward. The final numbers, they revised the forecast for FY24, the commission did, and it's now $52.59 billion, which is almost $2 billion higher than the budget revenue assumptions at the time the budget was enacted last spring. And it's $374 million higher than Gombe's revised forecast that came out at the time of the governor's budget address last month. And as they look for FY2025, the estimate is down a little bit. It's $52.1 billion, which is $368 million higher than the revised estimate. But it's actually lower when you take into account one-time revenues that will not repeat itself. And it's also worth noting that the commission's estimate is $916 million below Gombe's estimate at the time of the governor's budget message. But the reason is, the commission says, the commission estimate doesn't include $1.1 billion in revenue adjustments, i.e. new taxes, that would require changes to state law. And if you take that out, COGFA's estimate is actually $182 million higher. And so the bottom line is that the economists at the commission say a slowdown in the nation's economy has yet to occur. Unemployment rates remain low. Consumer spending has maintained a relatively healthy pace. The outlook is pretty decent.
And Charlie, despite that, everybody seems still to be expecting we're going to see a little less money going forward. Of course, these revenue enhancements could help that the governor's wanting, but it's not necessarily happy days are here again. There's still concerns going forward, and spending's going to have to be watched pretty closely. Is that a good analysis of that?
Oh, yeah. And as we've mentioned before, the asks from agencies and departments and interest groups are always going to be greater than the revenue that's available. The State Board of Education asks for a lot more money. I forget the exact amount, but it was in the hundreds of millions of dollars more than what the governor's budget is going to allow for. There have been calls for increased spending on health care, increased spending, as we mentioned, for the migrants, but on other health care issues as well, raising salary for some of the folks to be able to hire enough people to fill positions in DCFS or in corrections or in some of the home health care workers. So it's not going to be an easy budgeting year, but it's going to be better than what was anticipated earlier. And part of it is the state is getting additional money, and this is kind of difficult to explain, but one of the things that the state does in its budget every year is set aside a certain amount of money that it thinks will be needed to pay income tax refunds to taxpayers who submitted, who had more withholding than they actually owed. And one of the things that the commission noted is that because the economy was good enough, a lot of taxpayers wound up paying more than what had been anticipated. And so this fund that was set up to cover tax refunds is going to have a lot of extra money in it, several hundred million dollars. And so that goes back into the pot, and that helps the bottom line look better.
All right.
And there are a couple other things like that, too, technical things that have an impact on the bottom line, so making more money available. But as you said, Sean, we still are not in a situation where we can do everything that everybody wants.
When the budget talks starting to heat up, they should be passing a budget by the end of May this year. Heather, let me go back to you on a story, something I've been following quite a bit. Of course, Barack Obama has a lot of ties to Springfield, having served here, made his presidential announcement. We have the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum here in Springfield. But the Obama Presidential Center, we've been hearing about that for a long time. That is set to be built in Chicago, and a lot of people are looking forward to that. But what's the latest? It sounds like delays and delays and even more.
That's right. So originally, the center had been slated to open in October of 2025. Now, even that has been just a massive delay, because if you cast your memory all the way back, Obama picked Chicago's Jackson Park for the home of his privately run presidential library back in 2015, with an opening date set for 2021. Now, obviously, that didn't happen because of a protracted legal battle over its location in Jackson Park, which is on the federal list of National Historic Protected Places. There was also a group that sued to prevent the library from being constructed there. Now those court challenges are out of the way, and construction is underway, but it has been delayed again until the spring of 2026 to open. So that will be more than a decade after Obama actually picked Jackson Park. And that just is a sense of just how difficult it can be, not only to build, but specifically to build in Chicago's parks. And there's been, of course, a lot of talk lately about whether the Bears will be able to build a new stadium, as they apparently now seem to want, on the lakefront, also on parkland. And I think this is really a sign of just how difficult that may turn out to be.
Yeah, Charlie, it's hard to get everybody on the same page. I guess that's a good lesson here.
Yeah, and that's true. And as a matter of fact, kind of as a side note, one of the things that people objected to about building the Obama Center in Jackson Park was a loss of some park land. And to kind of replace some of that land, it was announced this week that the Obama Foundation is making a $4 million donation to the Park District to construct an adaptable playground at just almost like across the street from the Obama Presidential Center. And so you say, oh, that's great. But on the other hand, the people who are most affected by this, the neighbors, are not very happy about it. This particular area that the Obama Foundation says will put the park, it's bounded on three sides by highly trafficked roads, and on the fourth side, it's got a railroad track. So that doesn't mean that this is not going to go forward, but as you said, Sean, it just points out that there's all kinds of obstacles and opposition that needs to be overcome.
Heather, since we have you on and we've been talking about Chicago, I did want to point out a story that you did, taking a look at police overtime in the city. So in about a minute, can you sum up the fact that apparently the city is spending a lot more on overtime for police?
I can do it in less than a minute. I can tell you the city is just spending a massive amount of money on police overtime. In all, $293 million in 2023 alone. That's 40% more in 2022, which was record-setting at the time. And it shows that the police department, which is still struggling with a number of issues, including persistently high rates of crime and violence on the South and the West Side, has real sort sort of struggles in sort of making sure that they have enough people to police the city and that they're deployed appropriately. I asked Mayor Johnson about my reporting. He said that he agrees that it is out of control and that he's frustrated. So we here at WTTW, who love reporting on overtime, will be keeping a close eye on any changes he makes.
All right. Well, Heather, we'll go to you first for our notes from the field.
Well, speaking of Mayor Johnson, the weather's getting warmer. We're starting to see tulips blooming, which means that city officials are starting to prepare for the summer months, which is typically and heartbreakingly among the most violent time in the city. Now, typically, you'll have news conferences where everybody will flank the mayor and pledge a renewed effort to reduce those violent incidents. With the city's top cop in full uniform and regalia standing next to the mayor, promising some kind of crackdown or intolerance for lawbreaking. But that's not what Mayor Johnson did this week. He sort of launched this annual ritual by promising to invest more money in the city's social safety net to directly confront the racial and economic disparities that confront Chicago. And he didn't really talk about law enforcement. He told me that was a deliberate strategy because it's clear that for too long, Chicago police have been asked to do too much to address Chicago's public safety issues, which of course is directly related to how much the department is spending in overtime.
Okay, and Charlie.
Well, we've reported, and it's been pretty widely spread, that former Chicago Alderman Ed Burke had pleaded guilty in an illegal City Hall shakedown scheme. Usually when that happens, and Burke's a lawyer, the lawyer will have some kind of discipline imposed by the Supreme Court. The Attorney Registration Disciplinary Commission, which is the arm of the court that handles these matters, petitioned the Supreme Court shortly after Burke was convicted, asking the court to suspend his law license on grounds that he engaged in what court rules characterize as moral turpitude. And the ARDC said the court has previously found that disbarment is warranted for conduct similar to the conduct here. But apparently, the Supreme Court is not able to act on that recommendation because at least four of its seven justices recused themselves from the matter. And it's not clear whether there's a way to get around that. The Constitution requires the concurrence of at least four justices to make any decisions by the Supreme Court. So it's not clear who the people were who recused themselves. Four of the current justices actually served on the court with Burke's wife, Ann Burke, who was on the court between 2006 and 2022. And the court doesn't reveal who the people were, but the logical conclusion is that the folks who served with Ann Burke said, no, we can't participate in this. And so it left only three justices eligible, and that's not enough to take action under the Constitution. And there apparently is no way around that unless we were, I guess, to amend the Constitution and to allow, in situations like that, someone from the appellate court to stand in.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Heather Cherone with Chicago Tonight. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.